Hello and welcome to the fifth interview of the expert series on being mentally tough. This interview series is of course being brought to you by Warwick Sue of visionacquisition.net.nz. And today I feel very privileged to have Gary Hermanson with us. Gary has been the lead sports psychologist for the New Zealand Olympic and Commonwealth Games teams since 1998, including the recent Beijing Olympics in 2008. He has also been the sports psychologist for the New Zealand Black Caps cricket team from 2005 to 2008, and his high performance background includes having played rugby and cricket at the first class level. So Gary brings a great deal of experience both as an athlete and a sports psychologist to this interview. Please enjoy. Today everyone, we're very fortunate to have Gary Hermanson, who is the current Olympic and Commonwealth Games sports psychologist for the New Zealand teams, and he's been providing that service since 1998 for the Commonwealth Games team and 2000 in Sydney for the Olympics team. Not only that, he's also been involved with the New Zealand Black Caps for about 3 years, touring with them overseas and in New Zealand from 2006 through to about 2008. And his own sporting background included representing Manawatu, the Turbos, who have had some great results recently, pushing Auckland hard, and also representing Wellington, and also the New Zealand Universities teams, which is where he pulls out his dual abilities, and where he also played cricket for the New Zealand Universities teams. And as I understand it, Gary, you've been working as a sports psychology consultant for over 20 years now.
Yes, one way or another, over 20 years.
Yep, and currently the lead provider for sports psychology services to the New Zealand Academy of Sport?
Well, I work with them as one of their providers, but my lead provision is with the New Zealand Equestrian Sport.
Yeah, we're very fortunate to have Gary today, and I just want Gary to tell us a little bit about how he became a sports psychology consultant, what path he chose, and what events came his way to lead him into this role that he does so well now.
Well, I guess the elements for me were my own sporting background. I've had, as you mentioned, the mixture of rugby and cricket, and in those sports played at reasonably high level in terms of was in the rugby field, played against international teams, was in the Wellington side that beat the Lions and also South Africa. And so having sort of faced that kind of challenge and remembering there are times that seemed so easy and did so well, and then there are times where it was tough and difficult, and when it came back to it, it always seemed to be an element of the mental side of sports. I've always had that kind of ongoing interest. And then in my early 20s, I also was involved in social work. That was my profession and education initially, and then that led into counselling. And I taught for about 30 years at Massey University and became a professor of counsellor education there. And so that kind of professional focus on people and the mind and the kind of environment and how people respond to that has been part of my professional life. And then they kind of sat side by side in many ways. And then in the early 90s, I had one of those serendipitous moments where you turn up when somebody's sort of talking about things, and the coach of the Manawatu rugby team was just taken over, a guy called Mark Donaldson.
So that was after you finished your playing day?
Oh, yeah. This was early 90s, yes. long time since my playing days were finished. So at this stage, I was working at Massey and in the counsellor education field. So Mark Donaldson, who I knew, who was an ex-All Black himself and was taking on the coaching role with Manawatu, as a result of a chat we had, he kind of asked me to come along and do some work with some of his players, and that sort of led to working more with the players and with the team, and then other people kind of showed some interest, and then alongside of that with the development of the academies, and so kind of things just took off from there. And then in the 90s, I was involved also a wee bit with people like Ken Hodge and others in the Sports Psychology Association that we developed. And so you kind of, you know, shift into that field and you become more conscious and aware of it. And it was a point of time also where people came to be more interested in that part of performance. And then in 1998, as you say, I was applied for and was appointed to the games in Kuala Lumpur, and then sort of continued on from there, really. So it's...
How did that process begin? As in, you said you're applied and appointed?
Yeah, well, what happened was that I made an application, and you never quite know what those processes are, but I just put forward a profile about what I had been doing and my background in terms of sport and education and professional work. And they made the decision that I take the game, that position for the games in Kuala Lumpur. And you know, the work that we did then presumably was satisfactory enough. And
well, obviously.
Yeah. So I've maintained that role. And that role is pretty much a mixture of working with individuals, but also very much a part of working with the team culture with regard to individual teams, but also the bigger teams. So there's a mixture of that individual performance psychology and the collective environment and the way in which that impacts on performance as well, really. So that's...
So you're talking about the village environment?
Well, village environment, but also within team culture. You know, there's kind of a ethos within the team around the New Zealand team as a one team, one spirit notion, where there's a lot of emphasis given to being a collective one team, first of all. And so if you're there because you're in the hockey team, then you're first and foremost, you're part of the New Zealand Olympic team, but then within that, you're part of the hockey unit. So there's a lot of work around trying to develop the New Zealand identity. And, you know, there are various aspects also to do with biculturalism as an aspect of who we are as a nation. And biculturalism, there are certain elements about that that are very important. Some of the rituals and procedures are very conducive to sense of belonging and connectedness and that kind of experience. And so a lot of work around building that, and the indications from athletes have been that that's played a significant part in their mindset and their performance overall. And so, you know, people like Dave Curry, who's set the leadership around that, and then people like myself and Amster Reedy, the bicultural consultant, people who've actually been quite instrumental along with the athlete support team and trying to create an environment that's going to be both supportive but also challenging for performance. And it seems to have been regarded as a appropriate sense of essence of what we're on about, really. So that was the other part of it. So it's a mixture of working with individuals, both those that I might have worked with beforehand, but also responding to needs as they arrive in that intense pinnacle Olympic Commonwealth Games environment. And that's largely what the role involves.
Yeah, and I guess two things come out of that for me. One of them is with the athletes that I've worked with that have gone overseas and it's been perhaps their first or second trip or even their third or fourth, it can still really trip them up, the whole change in that environment, the culture, the food, the language, the time zone, and so the importance of setting up that village, that Olympic village or that Commonwealth village, so that it is a place where they can return to find some of that familiarity again, I'm sure is a big part of allowing them to settle into setting themselves up for a good performance.
Yes, it is. It's a mixture of support, but also recognising that it's a high-performance environment as well, so the challenge is there. It's not just support for its own sake. It's being able to provide a platform and a haven for people to be able to come back and relax and be with other people who are in the same situation as they are. But then also, you know, it's geared towards what we're all there for. And I think the other part about it is it's a mixture of early on when you go away, it's that whole different culture experience. And there's a whole lot of, you know, gee whiz type experience that happens when you go to those environments. You're looking at certainly the Olympics, you're seeing, you know, names, faces of people who you've known on television, but here they are right in front of you and you're mixing and mingling with them. And the danger is early on that you can just get a bit phased by the whole thing. And I think that at those, there is a, you know, there's high performance, which is clearly what, you know, people are aspiring to. But there's also, I think, pinnacle performance, where you go to those situations where, in many ways, the Olympics, from our, in our professional sense, it always comes down to who turns up mentally on the day. Now that happens in many situations, but in the Olympics in particular, but or any pinnacle event where this is kind of significant and the expectations are high, then there's another layer of pressure and another layer of mental challenge, which athletes you just can't easily anticipate until you're actually in it. And so what you're trying to do, this is why the continuity is quite important, because you can help work with athletes knowing and trying to help bridge that. You may only get one shot at it for some, and therefore being able to anticipate, know what that extra pressure brings, and having the strategies and the mindset that's going to help you respond best is going to be really important. So that's the kind of other dimension to that layer of work.
Yeah, from your perspective, as in when you came into the teams about 10 years ago, to what you see now with respect to that village setup, has it been quite a change? Has there been a lot more inclusion of the Kiwiana or?
Yeah, it's been quite massive, and this has been largely instrumental based on Dave Curry's leadership and involvement. So there's been a lot of that, and all of us, I mean, a number of us have been there for some time now, so we're starting to kind of build on knowing what gets in the way and also know what seems to make a difference. And so there's that snowballing of experiences and you know, rituals and artifacts and all those things that help, because as you would know, that as listeners would know only too well as well, when you go offshore, one of the things that you almost revert to is the New Zealand identity. You know, it stands in good stead elsewhere, and you, a number of times that people go on tour and finish up doing hakas in all sorts of places, and you know, wearing rugby jerseys, and that is a way of identifying who you are. And the same thing happens with athletes. You know, it's a strength we have, and so we hope to build on. Now, the other thing that's been different in my experience overall is that there's been a gradual shift also in the stance that athletes have taken to mental work. In the past, in the 90s, if you take Kuala Lumpur, the first games that I was at, it was quite clear that athletes regarded mental work as being problem oriented, so that if you were seen talking to me, then you know, you had a problem. And so a lot of the time that first game was relatively lonely. Actually, you kind of find that you know, you sit down at the dining table and people drift away from you a little bit because they don't want to be seen with you. And then over time, and this is to do with the academy and to do with, you know, the people who've been working in this area with athletes over time, I found that there's been quite a shift away from problem focus into opportunity focus, and people are much more looking for that edge, looking at trying to enhance the part of themselves. And so in the most recent games, I was at in Beijing, for example, I've had people shouting out across the dining room, don't forget we've got an appointment at 2 o'clock, all that sort of stuff. So there's not the same kind of shame dimension of that. There's much more recognition at that elite level that part of, in fact, it's the, you know, probably the major part of what's going to happen in this experience. And so you better get yourself geared up to it. Otherwise you're going to miss the bus, really.
Yeah. I think you've sort of really touched on it there. It's a real understanding now of what mental skills provides, whereas in the past there was a ignorance or a naivety around mental skills in sports psychology, and that it was, like you say, problem based, and that person must be dealing with something.
Well, it's a very personal, you know, it's a very personal thing. I mean, the mental side is pretty much, you know, tied into our identity and who we are and how we function. And so any intrusion into that area or any kind of, you know, it's hard to draw a barrier between, okay, we're just focusing on your performance mentality, because that's also related pretty much to the performance related experiences that people are involved in, you know, so family and your own kind of, your own abilities and your own sense of who you are. And so, inevitably there's that kind of tension around giving away that space for somebody else to enter into and work within, or, you know, shared work within. So it's pretty inevitable, I would have thought, that that's going to happen. But as people, they can separate their own personal ego and their own personal self from it, that's made a difference. But having said that, I'm also, you know, saying that a number of elite athletes dabble in it, they haven't really come to grips with seeing it as work to be done. It's almost like, oh, sometimes, you know, they accept it much more, but they're still looking at it as being something, oh, well, if I have a session, that might make a difference. Whereas in reality, you know, people like myself and very other people I'm sure you've interviewed are seeing it as a dimension to be worked on. And it's the same thing as if you take the Black Caps experience, you know, I was quite astounded at the number of hours that players put into net practice and skill drills and all those things. And yet when it comes down to working on the mental side of it, it's largely left over to things like, you know, inspirational messages or little kind of keywords here and there. And whilst that can make a difference, ultimately the major difference is going to come about from understanding what's to be done and working on it. And that's a mixture of them being prepared to make that commitment. But the other part of it is that we, as people in the mental skills and sports psychology field, have to do, I think, a better job of being able to package and present what we do in a way which is set up for work and, you know, mental work, mental training, mind management, rather than, oh, here's a discrete skill here or a discrete skill there, you know, do a bit of imagery, do a bit of goal setting, whatever. We need to work harder and better at being able to say, look, here's the framework of the mental side of what's going to make a difference, and here's how you can go away and work on it, and this is what, you know, so we can check in much more and we can develop a relationship, or you can go away on your own and just work on this as a program rather than as a isolated set of actions and behaviors that people then engage in and work with.
Yeah, I think, that's a really important point, is having people get that buy-in that, yeah, we need to improve on our mental skills, just like we need to work on our technical skills consistently, and those things will change as we improve in these different areas, and we'll find that we need to just tighten up this little bit here, just like it would be in a technical aspect of the sport that's being played. So it's, yeah, quite important. And I think it's based a lot around perhaps an education to the broader range of athletes that are out there, and so that when they make it towards elite levels as well, that they are looking to improve their mental aspects, not just starting to be introduced to them.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I mean, education is one thing, but I think there's also just a fundamental mindset. I mean, there are people, athletes, just like us all, who have rather fixed mindsets around capabilities and abilities. You know, it's kind of like, well, that's who I am, and therefore, you know, how do I tweak around the edges? And they're a bit closed-minded about things, and they feel a bit threatened about something to do with, you know, that abstract kind of getting into the mental side of what's to be done. And then there are people who are much more developmental in their mindset. They see themselves as being on a journey for growth and development and you know, the opportunity to maximize what's available to them. And so you often find with athletes that there's a quite a distinct difference between those who are ready to come and say, look, I want to work on this. I want to kind of commit to it. I want to kind of make a difference here. And then those who are saying, well, you know, yeah, let me have a kind of little taste of what's there. And okay, thanks very much. That's fine. Because fundamentally their mindset is one of needing to be a bit fixed and narrow. So, you know, some of that is education and reassurance and, you know, opportunity to exposure. And some of it, I think, is just fundamental mindset. We have to kind of recognize that not everyone's going to see or value or get involved with. So all we can do is keep putting that message out there and keep presenting ourselves in a way which is not threatening and accessible, and respect what we do and see ourselves as having something to offer, and, you know, work with those who are ready to go and keep on trying to be available and educate and promote and have people tempted to come and say, well, look, you know, I really want to make a difference here. And there is a point where often athletes come to where they realize that their skill preparation, their physical preparation is fine, and yet they still keep on undermining their potentials, and often they then come to a point of you know, crisis or just a point of crossroads and saying, well, if I'm really going to move into these top echelons and if they're really going to be able to perform at the pinnacle events, then I'm going to have to kind of really confront this and make a difference with it. And, you know, they are the opportunities that you kind of grab a hold of and run with, and that's great.
So just with your experience internationally, have you noticed a difference between various countries in their uptake of mental skills, or you're not really able to get an insight into the other countries?
Well, it's a bit hard to be able to generalise about that. I mean, in the games environment, there's usually, you know, most teams will have at least one sport psych with them. Some have many more. And then there's also been a bit of a shift over time because for those teams where they take their sports psych people as being only to work with individuals or with a discrete team like a soccer team or a hockey team or something, the players nowadays often come with a good fundamental knowledge and often a, you know, primary level of being able to use those skills. So I think for me, one of the important elements that I bring is my counselling profession background, because many of the athletes who are going to get there have certainly been exposed to and might be drawing on or not, but at least know what some of those fundamental skills are. But it's the crisis moments or the problem solving or the kind of, you know, in those sports where you have a go and things don't work out and then you're really frantic about how you can really make, you know, pick up on what's gone on and make the best out of what's left for you. That's available. Now, I think what happens is that in some of the other countries, because they are, both their athletes are coming along with that fundamental skill, they've therefore not committed as much to it. And also many of the others don't have that same one team, one spirit responsibility and looking at it's almost a social psychology part. And so, you know, the New Zealand Olympic Committee have made a commitment to that kind of role. But it's the same within the cricket environment. You know, when I was working with the New Zealand team and travelling around, there were some teams that had somebody on board in my role and some that didn't, and some who, I remember one occasion in West Indies where South Africa had a psychologist with them, and they brought him in, and he was largely in the grandstand and, you know, was there working with individual players. And the African boys at one point teased him a lot because I was down handing out water and, you know, lugging chili bins that around and whatever. And they saw him as not pulling his weight because he was just sitting up there and sort of, you know, available if they wanted it. And it's that kind of difference, you know, there's different roles. And I know African in England, a guy called Jeremy Snapes who works with them as well. So I think it's certainly recognised. And the elements at the moment, from what I understand, the Black Caps don't have anybody with them. And that's largely, as often happens, as coaches have different views about it. So they may have somebody involved or they may not. And that's an important thing as well. I mean, coaches are very critical gatekeepers for access to athletes. And very often the coach is a key figure in terms of athletes being able to access and being open to access the sort of work that we do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, basically the coaches are the ones that get heralded for a good performance or get the major criticism for a poor performance. So I can certainly see why they do hold that gatekeeping role very dear to their heart.
Well, they do, but many things that we do with athletes are highly applicable to coaches as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
Coaches sitting in the grandstand having their own emotional turmoil, and that's partly to do with what's going on in the field, but also in some situations it's, you know, being able to just stay in the moment rather than think ahead about, you know, how you're going to be received by the media or what's going to happen in terms of your contract or whatever. That's a very critical mental dimension as well. So, you know, a lot of the stuff we're doing with athletes are very applicable to coaches, and then coaches on top of that have a key impact into the team and into individual athletes if they're working with them individually. You know, the psychology of the athlete is very much dependent upon the psychological skills and abilities of the coach, and one way or another, you know, whether they are good at it or whether they're not, coaches are sports psychologists and athletes are sports psychologists to themselves and to others. And you know, what we're doing is trying to add something nation, but or, you know, right since sport has been a feature, sports psychology has been a feature as well. And if I think back to my own playing days, you know, in reality, my skill or lack of skill in particular games was my ability to harness my own psychology and make it work for me on the day, and other times not. And I, you know, think back now and think to myself, gee, if only I'd known then what I know now, those some of those terrible moments where you make some horrible mistakes and you rue that experience might have been different, and also you might have been able to maximize some of the talent that you had.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess that kind of leads in to what we want to actually discuss is the three main features of a mentally tough athlete. Perhaps you could call on your own experience there of what you saw as an athlete, and of course from your experience in the Olympic and Commonwealth Games teams of what you see as the three main features.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's pretty hard to pin down three main features, but for me, if you think about it, you know, you look at and say, well, there are a number of specific skills and also, I guess, attitudes around, you know, confidence and trust and those things that are there. And also, I guess, from a skill point of view, you can think about things like imagery and goal setting and what. But if I was to consider, you know, somebody said to me, look, if, and this is maybe what you're saying, you know, here's, I want three specific things and that's it. You know, I want you to give me what you think makes the most difference. And I guess that, yeah, so the first main thing I'd say is that at some level or other, I'm not saying that every elite athlete and every good athlete knows this within themselves, but there's a level at which they do recognize that they are in charge of their own mindset and in charge of their own thinking processes. And for me, once you can work with an athlete and get them to take ownership of their thinking, then everything flows on from there, because without that, then they always tend to kind of hope that their mindset will be, you know, will be right on the day. And so you can often hear this in the way in which they use language, for example, you know, like my mind just wandered, you know, as an example, which wandered, that it was because they allowed it to wander, or they, you know, wandered it, as it were. And so you're looking at the way in which athletes can take that responsibility and run with it, because without that, then they're dependent upon other people doing things for them, or other people somehow or other connecting with their own mentality to make a difference. But if they can own it and take responsibility for it, and you see it happen with athletes who are at that top level, who are natural at what they do, who still struggle when it comes to the pinnacle moments, because as I said before, that's a very specialized, narrow band of performance, which brings its own, I think, quite unique challenges. But at the ordinary level, they sort of know and understand that they are in charge of their own preparation and in charge of their own mindset, and then they apply it in the moment. So one of the first ones. And then on top of that, there's an element for me which is to do with attitude towards pain. And by pain, I mean, you know, just the discomfort that comes from having to train and get up there and you know, in the early hours of the morning, or when you could
continue to make sacrifices.
Yeah, you've got to make a choice between sitting on the couch here and watch a bit of TV, or do I get up and, you know, even if it's something like throwing darts, you know, if I'm a professional dart player, then I still have to be able to go somewhere away from distractions and put in the hours that are necessary just to be able to hone my skills, but also discipline my mentality. And, you know, I find often that the top level performer in a strange sort of way embraces the discipline and embraces the pain that goes with that. You know, the physical dimensions to it, but also that psychological aspect of it when you're having to push hard and having to make a difference. And that's a mental piece in particular. But there's those people who kind of, you know, really back off and avoid pain, and they look for avoidance of it as a way of release. They kind of, you know, more inclined to look for the pleasure that goes with experiences more than the discipline and pain that has to go in to be able to lay that platform down. So you get those who will avoid it, and then you'll get those who will tolerate it, and those people tend to be reliant upon coaches to push them into that pain area, you know, whether it means extra exertion or whether it means just the discipline of staying in the experience, then they will do it, but they'll do it if they have to, kind of thing. And then you'll get the others who are most often those elite athletes who are self-generators, who are autonomous in terms of what they do, and they tend to embrace it. They know that pain is going to be what has to happen. You know, if you take Sarah Ulmer as a case in point, you know, she knew that when she got on her bike at the beginning of a race, that when she got to the final lap of what she was doing, she'd have tunnel vision. The pain in her muscles would be excruciating, and her breathing would be really tough, and she'd have to do that. And so that's part of the sport, and you try and push the limits so that you can push the level to which that might kick in. But ultimately, you know that if you're going to try and compete, then that's what you have to do. And so somebody like that and others who have that ability, you seem to be able to just go in there and say, well, this is part of what I do. So that would be another fundamental mental quality.
Yeah, so illustrate that a bit further. There's a pain which you would recognize, especially in the discipline-type sports, which is a real physical pain. And then for those that are perhaps more skill-based, like you said, the darts sort of situation, it's perhaps more of a mental choice pain of sacrifice this so that they can do that. But it's still, yeah, still pain.
Even though in some sports you can see pain in terms of being the physiological pain, and in other sports you think, well, where's the pain in, you know, throwing a dart, for example. But it's that each of those have a psychological dimension to pain. And if you think about the athlete who's in a very physically demanding, where the whole kind of lactic acid thing is going to be part of what they do, there's also a moment where they have to make that psychological decision to either push into it or pull back from it. And we've been, you know, individually reared to take a stance towards that, really. And, you know, one of the criticisms about modern day youth, you could say, is that for many of them, not all, but for many of them, there's a kind of a pleasure-seeking upbringing where you kind of look for the easier option. And whereas for others, those that haven't had the exposure, they tend to therefore be able to push on and see the demands of physical training and the psychology, the discipline of that to be important. And so they kick in. And now, you know, the old messages, well, in the older days, you know, we sort of had it hard and you had to do this and you had to do that, to some extent is true. I think now it's a bit of an overgeneralization, but I think with the modern day athlete, those who are succeeding and doing well tend to be those who've been brought up to recognize that, you know, life sometimes is tough and you've just got to be able to get in there and work at it. Sometimes it works to your advantage and other times it doesn't, but what you got to do is kick on and you know, give it all you can, and that can be difficult at times. And pain isn't something to avoid. It's something to manage and from pain comes exhilaration and opportunity. So I'm not kind of pushing the notion that, you know, we're going to just push everyone into pain levels that are going to be excruciating either physically or psychologically. But I'm looking at from the point of view of those athletes that are able to make it to the top level and those that aren't. I think there is a kind of a psychological response to pain, which is, you know, that pain, physical pain, psychological, is quite an element for them, which is important. Then the third one, which probably in terms of, you know, this is now much more into the control of thinking, much more. If I was to be asked, you know, which is the key element, would be the ability to not only understand, but also to apply the difference between outcome thinking and process thinking. That with outcome, if you get preoccupied by that, you're going to be, with winning comes losing, with outcome thinking comes time traveling mentally. You go into the future and you're more concerned about what might happen rather than dealing with what you've got to do right now. And pretty much all athletes I've come across can explain that and can understand that. But whenever you get into the heat of competition, lots of athletes lose that ability to manage it. They get preoccupied by, if you're an equestrian ride and you knock a rail over, you're so busy trying to deal with the emotional effects of what that means in terms of the potential outcome. Or if you know there's a fence coming up and that's going to be quite critical as to whether you, win or lose or where you get in this competition, then you are in fact taking away a large percentage of your immediate attention on doing what you've got to do right now. And that ability to keep your head in the space, whether it's a bubble or whether it's, for a rower, keeping your head in the boat or for, whatever you can create for you, that's where you have to be able to keep your thinking going. And as I say, I think it's a sort of skill or ability that athletes can explain, but under pressure, they regularly don't apply it. And those that can manage it are the ones that tend to be able to do well consistently. And but I think it's a challenge for all. And if I give you a public example of what I mean by that, if you take the twins, Caroline and Georgina Evers-Swindell, when they were leading up to Beijing, having won in Athens with a gold medal, they then faced that rather tormenting dilemma about, okay, now we're the defending gold medalists, how are we going to approach Beijing? And the Chinese were doing well, and so there's a tendency to get preoccupied about, can we win the gold again in Beijing? And some of their performances were a bit erratic in the lead-up. And then for those that are aware of it, in about 6 weeks before the Beijing competition, they went to a world championship race in Poland, I think it was, and did so badly that they were really embarrassed themselves. They were kind of ashamed of what they'd done, and that immediately shifted.
They ended up in the B final in that one, didn't they?
Well, that's right, yeah, which was for them so totally unusual as to be a shock. And what it did for them is it took their struggles away from outcome, which had been, can we repeat this gold medal performance, totally into process stuff. How can we row a race in which we can engage ourselves in the experience that will enable us to hold our head up at the end of it all and have respect for our performance. So the shifted into being able to manage their performance rather than control the outcome from that point of view. And as we know, they raced a great, powerful race. They kept their head inside the boat. They managed to be able to get to the point where when the race was over, they didn't even know whether they'd won or not. And in a sense, for them, it didn't seem to matter. What mattered was that they'd actually restored their own sense of respect and credibility and trust in their own abilities. And golly, at the end of it all, the real double plus is that we've also won the gold medal here. And for me, that's a kind of prime example about the dilemma that athletes get into. There's so much preoccupation because we're often, we're brought up that way to see that winning is what matters and anything else is a kind of a failure, that a lot of anxiety gets locked into outcome thinking. And so, as I say, there's nothing new in what I'm saying, because everyone understands the difference and everyone can explain it. But the real quality that a top level athlete has is that ability in the moment to make it work for you. And I think it's no coincidence that many of our gold medalists in the Olympics over the years have often been people who are in their second performance where their first performance was a real disappointment for them. Hamish Carter in Sydney 2000, where the preoccupation was pretty much around winning the gold medal, went into Athens with a different mindset altogether. Murray Holberg in 1956 left the Melbourne Games shaking his fist at the flames, saying, "You haven't seen the end of me yet," because he was, you know, disappointed. He'd gone into that particular competition expecting, and all the others' expectation was that he had the podium, and he hadn't ran very well at all. And so when he went into his next games in Rome, he went with a different mindset, because the emphasis there was on what to do to get the job done, rather than, you know, winning or losing. And so I think, as I said, no coincidence that most of our athletes, Sarah Olm had an injury illness in Sydney, and didn't perform the way that she had hoped for. And so going into Athens was a totally different mindset for her as well. Now, what we have to do is try and, you know, circumvent that, coming off a bad experience as a way of learning, to shift your mindset in that way. And so the more we can actually help athletes to not only understand but to practice and apply that discipline is, I think, one of the key elements in being able to work and to use the mind to make performance excellent.
And that's, I think, leads back to what I was alluding to earlier, is the use of mental skills seems to, for the general population, or I could say those that are arriving into the elite levels, where they start to be introduced to it main. So they're very used to that outcome focus from the early part of their sporting arena, and they've practiced being in that outcome focus for so long. It takes a lot of determination, a lot of practice, and a lot of discipline to actually get that process focus once they're knowledgeable about it. And it's not something which happens overnight. It requires, yeah, a lot of practice and to put yourself into those different pressure scenarios. Otherwise, as we know, that when anybody's got under pressure, they go back to what they know. And unless that practice is really altered, yeah, that way of thinking, then they will go back to outcome focus until it's their main way is process focus again.
Yeah, there's always going to be slippage. And I think it's not one of those things that you will probably ever come to a point where you can say, "I've got that sussed," because there's always going to be subtle entices into, you know, thinking about that, whether it's, you know, external rewards like monetary rewards, where you suddenly find, gee, if I can just win this one as well, then this will, you know, this will happen. So it's inherent in high-level sport, is that there are tremendous rewards for being the one that stands on the podium. And so you're caught up always in that temptation to get drawn towards. It's a bit like, you know, the old-fashioned Greek sirens who sing enticing songs on the shore, and they entice the sailor onto the rocks, kind of thing. That you, if you're not vigilant and if you don't tie yourself to the mast, then you'll get drawn onto the rocks. And so I think that's the thing, is you can never ever say, "I've got that sussed," because suddenly, you know, it'll creep up on you again in a subtle way. And but what you can do is, as you say, as you need to just, you can't just say, "Oh, tick that box, that's done, this box is done." You're in a constant process of training, discipline, building that core mental strength, being able to, but always being vigilant for the way in which it's going to be affected in this competition, and this competition, and this preparation, and that preparation. And so that's where the whole program work is required, the ability to be able to get people into a level of understanding, but also to translate that into understanding into controlled application. And they are in charge of it. They make it happen. And you do the work off the competition arena, out of the competition arena, whatever that arena is, given the different sports. You do the work beforehand so that when you get into the arena, you don't have to keep on thinking to yourself, "What was it I was supposed to do?" Or what did that sports like tell me to do? Or what am I supposed to kind of do right now? And being able to put in the mental work and the physical work and preparation so that when you go into the competition moment, you can trust what you've done and you can apply it the way that's going to bring the best out of your mind and body working together. That's what you're after, but it's the work that goes on beforehand. And as I said before, that they're actually, you know, whilst you can use some of the skills like visualization and goal setting and self-talk and that, which are all very important, it's better done in a prolonged and systematic way beforehand, so that when you get in there, it's all locked in, rather than having to kind of keep on flipping out of what you're doing into some kind of self-monitoring process that enables you to think, oh yes, I better go and do this now. What was I supposed to think?
Yeah, so basically it's all the conscious thought is used for dealing with any unexpected issues, whilst the preparation of all the skills and practice beforehand allows the body and the mind to go through those pretty much automatically and unconsciously. All right. So basically, Gary, you talked about ownership and responsibility as being one of the main influences to the elite mentally tough athletes, and then the one which is really quite interesting is the pain factor and having the discipline to be able to make the decision to move further in towards that pain a lot of the time. And the third one, which we just finished, was with respect to the thinking processes, whether they're thinking along the lines of outcome or process thinking. And for me, there's just one thing in there that I find is really helpful. The outcome thinking is often good to help the motivation when we're looking at that pain and discipline that you talked about as the second point. Is thinking about that gold medal that you're going to win because you're making that sacrifice, because you're going a bit deeper into that pain, or even because you're taking that rest week seriously and actually resting yourself, because I think that's also a difficult decision for a lot of athletes.
Sure. I think, I mean, I'm not saying at all that outcome's not important, and you're right, it's an aspect of motivation. Not, you know, I think the motivation really comes down to dynamic goals more than anything else, and that's one factor of goal. But I think it's the ability to embrace that outcome. That's what you're doing it for, but that's where the mental element comes in. It's being able to therefore and to, you know, park that and come back mentally to what you've got to do. And because within that gold medal thinking, that outcome thinking, whilst there's motivation, there's also often a lot of anxiety. In fact, you're having to kind of shift your thinking into the future, and thinking in the future almost by definition is what anxiety is. You know, it doesn't have to be of an anxious kind. You can, if you're mentally, you know, positive and confident and you're geared up in such a way that you are motivated and driven, then that can be a factor. But at times, and more often than not, it carries with it anxiety. And so, yes, I'm not saying, oh, no, you mustn't think about gold medal if that's what that's what you're in it for. But you have to be able to mentally separate that when you're in the process of doing what you're doing. And that's the part that I think athletes don't always do well, particularly in those pinnacle event moments where the outcome is so far-reaching. It's not just whether you get another medal. This is, you know, this is going to change your life for many of those situations. This is going to be, things are never going to be the same. Are often that kind of, they carry with it that piece of motivation, but also that piece of dread, and, you know, in terms of being able to do it. So, yeah, it's a hard thing to separate out, but that's what I think is quite critical. And,
So ultimately for us, for the athletes that we're working with, the performance that they're having here at a local meet and the performance that they're having at the Olympics, we would ideally wish that they could not be able to separate the two of them, such that, yeah, they were so involved in the process itself, they were completely unaware of where that performance was taking place, so to speak.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, that's an approach to that particular dilemma. You know, a lot of times I say this is, you know, just another venue, so do that, and I think that's a good way to go. But sometimes that can be fraught because the athlete hasn't done the work to enable them to hold their mind in that right place. And one of the things that I do with athletes that I work with, and you know, some of them embrace it, some of them kind of find that this is a bit of a challenge about their discipline. But I, for me, one of the fundamental mental training skills is the whole business of meditation. And I don't mean meditation in a kind of a mystical religious sense. I mean just the ability to be able to practice putting your mind where you want it to be and holding it there. And you know, if you practice that, then when you get into those situations where you want to put your mind where it needs to be, you've already gone through the discipline and the training that enables you to do that. And so that's the difference, being able to say, not just, oh, this would be a good idea, but this is what I have to do, and I've done the fundamental core strength training to bring that about. And so that's a piece of, you know, what I would work with. I'd see that as a fundamental core skill, on top of which all these other things will then happen.
Absolutely. Yeah, so for your money, at least, and like you've caveated at the beginning, it's hard to actually put three particular aspects in place, but the responsibility and ownership, pain and discipline, and outcome thinking versus process thinking would be the ones that would tend to stand athletes out who achieve at that high level.
Yeah. On top of that, there are the other you know, bits and pieces that are clearly quite important as well. But if we're just, you know, for me, I always want to bring it back to what's the core of this. Then on top of that, you've got other things about, you know, being able to hold your confidence and being able to kind of, you know, because if you take confidence that is involved with having ownership of your thinking, as it were, and also doing the work, you know, being able to, you know, that you can actually push into that pain dimension, and you're confident because you know that you're in charge of what you can do. So if you took the word confidence and that experience of confidence, that flows through all those three things. Then there are particular things you can do on top of that around confidence, but that's part of that fundamental core.
Wow. Well, thanks very much for your time today, Gary. It's been highly enlightening, and I've really enjoyed especially discussion around that Olympic environment and how much that has changed in the time that you've been there, and how the athletes have responded to those changes, and perhaps more so the perspective that the athletes take on mental skills and sports psychology from when you first arrived and you were kind of left out on your own, eating on your own, to almost having the magical Lynx effect, you know, the aftershave deodorant, and everyone's now clambering towards you and wanting a piece of your time.
Well, it certainly makes it a bit easier when you know that people are starting to get themselves motivated to work in that way, and so you don't feel quite so isolated and strange.
And I also enjoyed that you discussed about how when you're there, you really get into that environment, like the Black Caps, for instance, and you're out there running the water bottles or moving the chili bins and around, and you're not just that person who stands in the room when they come to see you, or sits up in the stands watching, but you're actually part of the team, and that, I'm sure, helps with that rapport that you have to be able to pass it on.
Yeah, you've got to be able to carry bags and put up posters and that sort of stuff, and you know, the more straightforward and ordinary you are, then, and the more approachable. That's not, you know, but you also have to hold your professional credibility, but, you know, that doesn't require you to wear a lab coat and stand aloof and take people, you know, you've got to consult with people where you can, and sometimes that's standing in a stairwell or, you know, kind of quietly talking on a bus or something, and, you know, whilst I have a room in the Olympic environment, a lot of the work takes place where you can, really, and so, and that, I think, is how it should be, rather than just seeing it as being some kind of, you know, obviously there are some pieces of work you may have to go into that rather private environment because you're working in areas where privacy becomes even more critical. But, you know, in a lot of the times, providing you can get privacy in terms of being able to talk without other people overhearing, then you got to be prepared to consult where you can, and athletes, that's, you know, you have to kind of fit in with their their experiences and their challenges and their demands rather than anything else.
Absolutely. And I think also what that brings to the situation is that mental skills aren't something which are left in the classroom as well, or left in the office. They're, you know, they're used everywhere all the time, and there can be times of crisis where you need them in a stairwell or something like that. It's just where it comes across.
Absolutely, and you know, you're right that I think for so long now it's almost been, let's have a mental skills session, and that's good, we've done that, we can tick that box. And but you know, to really make a difference, we have to be able to move beyond that into by no means the same amount of hours as you have to put into the physical, because that's fundamental and critical and makes, you know, a big difference as well. But proportionately, there's scope for being able to do more structured mental work. And I think that is as much a challenge for us in terms of being able to both convey how we view it, but also to put what we do in such a framework that enables it to be seen as being work that can be done in a programmatic way.
All right. Well, again, thank you very much, Gary. It's been a pleasure speaking to you today, and I certainly have gained a lot from this interview, as I'm sure all my listeners will as well. So, catch up with you soon in person again.
Good stuff. All right. Thanks, Warwick.
And that's it for this week from Warwick Sue of visionacquisition.net.nz. Remember to leave a comment on my blog at va.net.nz/blog, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.